This is The Cable.
How much retail ownership is in stocks?
Tech story is front and center.
What will this wind up doing to the cost curve?
Your connection from the London market close to the US market action.
A significant sell-off in European assets.
So it feels like a lot of these stocks have already priced that in.
This is a stock that is increasingly being shorted.
The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele.
Behavioral challenges from the pandemic could linger for years
on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening, welcome, 5pm in the City of London, Tuesday, August the 9th. A lovely day out there. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? We're going to discuss that during this programme. I'm Guy Johnson alongside Marcus Ashworth this evening. US equity markets just beginning to roll over now. The Nasdaq is down by 1.3%, the S&P down by 0.4%. The FTSE finishing flat, energy stocks having a good day as part of a key pipeline delivering oil out of Russia. Got shut down by the Russians today because of an argument over transit fees, further squeezing Europe in its time of need. There's lots to discuss around this energy story. We've also got headlines crossing that potentially the UK could be facing blackouts this January in the worst case scenario. Marcus, how are you feeling today?
a bit of project fear, nothing better. Yeah, I mean, I'm not 100% sure about what a lot of woulda, coulda, shouldas could happen in January, February. A lot of things could have happened and changed by then. But I think all of Europe, particularly continental Europe, is facing shutdowns and things way, way before then. And everyone's reliant on each other. So it's a true test of European unity because, as the article points out, a lot of UK energy is going across to Europe at the moment. And I hope things will be reciprocated when usually in the winter, the UK always just takes from particularly from Norway and some from interconnectors in Belgium and France. So it's testing times ahead, eh?
Yeah, it's going to be a fun winter. I bought the generator back earlier on this year, much to the noise of my wife. I'm thinking I might have to give it a quick test, get it ready before the winter arrives.
Mine's not attached.
Yeah, no, nor's mine. Mine's not attached. I have to sort of put it through a hole in the wall, but I'm sure I can figure that out. Let's talk about what is happening more broadly. Let's get some headlines. Here's Charlie Pellett.
Hi, thank you very much, Guy Johnson. Happy Tuesday. Want to begin with that UK winter energy story. The UK planning for several days over the winter when cold weather may combine with gas shortages, leading to organized blackouts for industry and even households. Under the government's latest reasonable worst-case scenario, sources say Britain could face an electricity capacity shortfall totaling about a sixth of peak demand, even after emergency coal plants have been fired back up. Europe's energy security took another hit today after Russian crude flows through Ukraine to Hungary, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic were halted because sanctions prevented payment of a transit fee. Domino's Pizza is saying arrivederci to Italy. Domino's footprint in the home of pizza proved to be short-lived when Italians favored local restaurants over the American version. The last of Domino's 29 branches have closed after the company started operations in the country 7 years ago. It borrowed heavily for plans to open 880 stores, but faced tough competition from local restaurants expanding delivery services during the pandemic and sought protection from creditors. That is the latest from the news desk. We covered all. Guy Johnson, back to you now in London.
Tough to sell American pizzas to Italians, I have to say.
You know, and Guy, I got thinking.
That was always going to be a challenge.
I got thinking about American beer in England.
Yeah, again.
We love it.
No, you don't.
Of course we do. Absolutely.
We just do.
Well, I have to say, so we digress for a moment, but I have to say American beer used to be terrible and has actually got really good now. So
I agree.
You can enjoy that improvement. There are plenty of good options there, but I'm not sure the pizza story is really ever going to fly. I think that was always going to be a tough ask to sell American pizzas to the Italians. Charlie, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Charlie's going to be back in around 30 minutes' time to keep us updated. So there's some debate in the UK right now as to whether or not we are heading for a recession. Clearly, the Bank of England has warned that we are heading for a significant one. We've now got this energy story that we could be seeing blackouts this winter, which would only exacerbate the economic outlook. We've also got Bloomberg Economics trying to sort of wade into the middle of this, suggesting that the UK is heading for a recession, even if Liz Truss delivers a significant fiscal impulse for Britain over this winter. There's this other chap that's arguing on the other side of it. I think he's called Marcus Ashworth. Bank of England's apocalyptic prophecies falling on deaf ears was a note that he penned into today. Marcus, how finely balanced do you think it's going to be? The data that is being crunched by Bloomberg Economics suggests that while the trust tax cuts would have an impact, they would probably not be enough to avoid the recession that the Bank of England is talking about.
Well, I'm still stuck on pizza and beer, personally. And I just wanted to say, Charlie, I just love American beer, any beer. And equally, if you think American pizzas are bad to whatever, try British pizzas into China, which is what Pizza Express tried to do. That went even worse. Anyways, we digress. I think that, again, as a bit like the Bank of England doesn't have the ability to put into its models of what is planned from Liz Truss with regards to tax cuts, I don't think Bloomberg Economics either yet can know what is going to happen with regards to further handouts. And they're coming fast and thick and fast because if you know, we look at some of the forecasts on what bills are going to be coming out, the government is going to have to react to this. Net, 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 I don't think the UK economy is going to do anything other than flatline. It may dip a bit. I don't think if it's going to be a recession, it will be anything other than mild at present, which is basically what Bloomberg Economics is saying. And to be fair, the Bank of England isn't predicting a particularly sharp recession. It's just, it's quite weirdly, this is going to go on for very long. That's the thing that caught me. It's like seven quarters of no growth and negative growth is a, you know, nearly 2 years worth of nothingness is to my mind too pessimistic, because I do think the government is going to have to react. The government hasn't got a lot right of late. And certainly, I think fiscal tightening has been proved to be, hasn't tested well with reality. And I think, therefore, whoever is the next prime minister is going to have to change it.
Do we think that this could end up being even greater than the pandemic response? Because the pandemic response was pretty large.
No.
So you've got Sunak delivering a £15 billion package back in May. And this is related to energy. And he delivered an even bigger one before that relating to the pandemic.
Right.
The problem with the pandemic one, it was very, very targeted. And that's going to be the issue this time round. How targeted can the effect, will the effect be? And I think that's where the challenge is really going to lie here.
He has set the precedent for making sure that the lowest third of income will not pay anything more than they paid last year. So I think that's the precedent's been set. As everyone says, you know, so £1,200 is going to come in, as it's now going to jump up to 4,000, then, you know, you're looking at that more than trebling. So, you know, I don't see how he's going to be able to, the next chancellor, whoever the move, is going to be able to do anything other than follow what has already happened. The stuff that was put in May will have to be repeated again in September, October, and more again, probably in early January. Yes, there's going to be a lot more money in, but will it be less than the pandemic, which of close to $400 billion? Almost certainly.
Let me just ask you, as a quick aside, I just wanted to ask you this question because I've been thinking about it. If this winter goes badly, will whoever succeeds Boris Johnson remain as Prime Minister? I.e., will whoever succeeds Boris Johnson inevitably contest the next general election?
I think yes. But it could go anyway. The point here is, if the replacement prime minister is able to show that they're doing as much as they can, and if the Labour Party continues to offer literally zero alternatives because they're against everything or saying nothing of any validity, then I think there is a chance. However, things are going to go wrong. Almost certainly everything goes wrong. Events, dear boy, and I therefore worry what will happen.
Marcus is going to stick with us. It's Marcus and me throughout the rest of the show. Sorry about that. Up next, we're going to be talking about what is happening with mortgage rates here in the UK and the average duration of a mortgage. We'll talk about that next. They're at 30-year highs. Neil Callanan's going to join us to discuss. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
So a mortgage is, by definition, a contract till death. And it appears as if that's becoming more and more the reality of the situation, Marcus. So Neil Callanan crunching the numbers for us regarding what is happening here in the UK. For the average first-time buyer, the average duration of the mortgage that is now being taken out because of affordability and the need to spread the cost over a very long period of time is now 30 years. Neil joins us now in the studio. Neil, how unprecedented is this?
Well, completely, because it's never actually happened before. It's a record length, and in many ways it just shows the desperation that people are feeling to get on the housing ladder in the UK at the moment, that they're willing to borrow for much longer in order to reduce their monthly repayments in order to be able to afford property, which is currently at the most unaffordable level it's ever been in the UK at 8.3 times annual earnings. So you have these confluence of factors that are really pushing first-time buyers to the extreme. And I suppose the concern around all that, given what you've just been discussing about the threat of recession, is what happens to these buyers in 2 or 3 years' time, yep. Even when interest rates have increased, and more importantly, if banks feel that they've overextended by going to 30 years next time out, are they going to pull back and maybe make it 25 years? And then are buyers going to face a double whammy of both rising interest rates, pushing up their repayments, but also shorter durations, which push up their payments even further? And that's when you might run into problems.
Neil, excuse my misunderstanding here, but I mean, obviously, the usual term needs to always be 25 years. But things have moved on, and we have obviously both the States and indeed, obviously, let's move on from Japan for the moment. But you know, this is just moving forward to more flexible mortgages. No bank's going to write a loan isn't comfortable writing. And the point of a 30-year or 25-year mortgage when you're a first-time buyer is that you're almost certainly not going to stay with that more than the 2 or 5-year fix that you're doing. So what difference does it make? I mean, really, what is this not money shy in the sense that it's gone from 29.9 to 30.1. This is a gradual trend towards more flexibility and offering first-time buyers perhaps a way of slightly defraying their repayment costs.
Absolutely, Marcus. And I suppose the question comes down to risk in the end. And so what banks have been doing is making it easier for people to afford repayments that otherwise they couldn't possibly make. That's pushed up prices. The question is, in 2-3 years' time, depending on how long this recession happens, depending on the economic outlook, are the banks going to be happy to take the same level of risks? The banks have cut margins substantially in order to remain competitive. Again, in a few years' time, we just don't know what's going to happen about whether they're going to have to push up those margins in order to keep the business. We don't know what the interest rate outlook will be. And then it's the duration risk comes into it then as well. In 5 years' time, will the bank still be wanting to lend for 30 years?
Why do we not find ourselves in a situation as we do in the United States, where if I take out a 30-year mortgage, the rate is fixed for 30 years. That is a 30-year mortgage to my mind. Effectively, what we're taking out here are 2-year, 5-year mortgages, just with a lower interest rate, but ultimately more capital at the end of it that needs to be rolled over into another mortgage. This seems like a slight sort of mislabeling of the products that are being delivered here. Are we ever going to find ourselves in a situation here in the UK where I go to a bank and say, I'd like to take out a 30-year mortgage, and they give me a 30-year mortgage?
Well, the government would like that to happen, and they are currently looking at ways to introduce 40 to 50-year mortgages that you could actually move between generations. So in terms of Conservative Party, that's definitely part of their
And the rate I take out. So Alex Steele took out a mortgage last year. It was 2.39%. That is for the duration of the entire mortgage, 30 years at that rate.
What we don't have in the UK, though, is the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac that help make that possible.
Exactly.
And insurers do want to come into that market and potentially do that, but it will require massive structural reform of the market before that can happen.
Neil, great story. Fascinating. Interesting to see what is happening in terms of the housing market. Does it start to roll over? Maybe that provides another opportunity for maybe a slightly more benign environment for these first-time buyers. We'll continue the conversation, talk about what is happening with the UK economy, what is happening more broadly in the leisure market as well. That conversation next. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening, welcome back. You're listening to The Cable. We're live on DAB Digital Radio. The European energy story took another big blow today after Russian crude flows through Ukraine into Hungary, Slovakia, the Czech Republic were halted because sanctions prevented payments of transit fees for the pipeline. Basically, this is oil coming out of Russia through a pipeline into those countries, which is no longer available. Further providing evidence of an energy story which is deteriorating rapidly in Europe. Over in the United States, we have seen oil prices coming down recently, this feeding into a narrative that maybe inflation has peaked. But I have to say, speaking to Scott Sheffield, who is the CEO of Pioneer, one of the biggest shale producers in the United States a little bit earlier on, I'm not convinced that this is going to be a story that has got legs. That energy prices, according to Scott, are going to remain really quite elevated for really quite some time. In fact, that he thinks we're going to see $100 a barrel for really the next 5 years. And one of the reasons for that, costs remain incredibly elevated in this industry. I caught up with him a little bit earlier on alongside Katie Greifeld to talk about what is happening on that cost front and whether or not he sees any evidence that inflation has peaked.
No, we talked about it on our earnings call. We still see another, if you look at our current run rates today, we see about a 10% increase going into 2023 budget. We mentioned that on the call, so we have not seen any slowdown on inflation at this point in time.
And that 10% increase, I mean, what is the main driver behind that? And has that changed over the past year or so?
We were probably up 10 to 15% this year. You could say if it is 10% next year, it's slowing a little bit, but it's primarily on diesel, number one, which is all tied to what oil price does next year. Secondly, pipe, tubular goods is up significantly. And the rest of it is pretty much scattered throughout the industry. Completions, fracking, cementing, and so on.
Do capital budgets therefore have to go up? Do they continue to go up, Scott?
Yes, going into next year, the CapEx will be going up. We're targeting still long-term 5% production growth. And as we showed on our earnings slide, a long-term dividend yield, which will be the highest in the S&P 500 of any company, at $100 oil over the next 5 years at about 12%.
And Scott, I know you don't do the capital budget until later in the year, but I am curious with the rate of inflation as it is, what's the bar to actually grow the budget higher than inflation?
I don't think so. I mean, we're targeting 5% production growth. And so we basically said on the earnings call at about 10%. And then we're adding a couple rigs per year. Each rig, you know, adds roughly $100 to $125 million per year per rig. And so most of the research analysts can get fairly close on what our budget is for 2023.
Scott, what are you hearing from the servicing companies? Their pricing power is absolutely enormous at the moment. They clearly have to pass on a lot of the costs through the industry. What are they telling you about what they need from you, what kind of investment they need to be making? What is that relationship like right now?
Yeah, we have a great relationship with all of our service contractors since we're either number one or number two largest producer in the Permian. We get premium pricing from all of our service companies. We have mechanisms that we can look back. They have to match. If they give pricing that's less than Pioneer's, they have to give us that pricing in all of our agreements. And so we have great mechanisms to know that we have probably some of the lowest cost. But in regard, they have to replace their equipment over time. They have to replace their rigs. They have to replace their frack equipment. And most of the frack equipment will be going to what we call e-fleets, to electric fleets. They'll be off the grid over the next several years. So they have to replace the old diesel, the older fleets. So they have to make a margin. It's not reflected in their stock prices. We're seeing the same thing in regard to the upstream energy stock prices. We're all trading very cheap, including the service companies.
That was Scott Sheffield from Pioneer talking to Katie Greifeld and myself a little bit earlier on. Marcus, the US is energy independent. It feels like it's on a different planet right now.
Doesn't it? Just, yeah, it's now, I think, the biggest exporter in that sense. And it has sometimes it has the wrong type of oil in the wrong place, which involves it trading a lot. through the Louisiana offshore oil port. But I mean, you know, there is a lot in that recent clip there, which makes me smile, because I do love Texas oil men pleading poverty at the same time as eulogizing how good their stock is. There's a fundamental disconnect between the Biden administration's desire to hit net zero and a bunch of other ambitions on green energy, and perhaps having, should we say, fully supplied and the right type of distillate and various other products at the right place at the moment. And it's, so the US does have problems. It has issues, which is a sort of big disconnect between the industry and the administration, which I don't think the Biden administration is going to get much progress with unless they completely back down on a whole bunch of, you know, i.e. the canceled pipelines and a raft of other stuff. So for the moment, this guy's business seems in pretty good shape with $100 barrel of oil. I think he's in a fortunate place.
Absolutely. What I think is interesting at the moment is there is this desire clearly to back off some of the carbon reduction plans that came out of Glasgow.
Yeah.
Is that sensible policy, do you think? Is there a danger that we end up sort of stifling innovation, which ultimately could reduce quite significantly energy costs?
It depends who you listen to, and there's 1,000 different views here. But, you know, the short term here and now, if you want to get through a winter, particularly in Europe, but also in the UK, without blackouts, something has to be done. And that's why coal has been imported, ironically, from Russia. You know, a raft of other things. Hot water has been pumped in by nuclear power stations in the Rhone in France. A lot of things have got to change. But that doesn't mean net zero has to be derailed. It's just the timescale needs to be adjusted, and more innovation will be coming down the pipe.
Marcus and I are going to stick with you. Up next, we're going to take you to Mar-a-Lago in Florida. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. Welcome. You're listening to The Cable. We're live on DAB Digital Radio. Quick update on where we sit with markets stateside. The S&P now down by 0.6%, just softening up as we speak. The Nasdaq down by 1.6%. Another warning from the chip sector, this time in the form of Micron, just rattling the market a little bit. But we're also preparing ourselves for tomorrow's CPI print. It's expected to soften, but some are suggesting that actually we could continue to see hot prints. And if we do, we're going to get a big market reaction. We'll talk about all of this over the next half hour. We're going to focus more on what is happening stateside over the next 30 minutes. Let's set ourselves up for that. Here with the headlines, Charlie Pellin.
Hi, thank you very much indeed, Guy Johnson. Here's what's going on. Londoners have been told to prepare for a hosepipe ban as the city faces another heat wave. Thames Water, the utility that serves London, said it could not confirm exactly when the ban will kick in, but is urging families to use as little water as they need to get by. The Health Security Agency has issued a heat health alert for all regions from today through 11 p.m. on August 14th, when the Met Office is warned of extreme heat, particularly in London and southeast England. England, by the way, registered its driest July in almost 90 years. France also registered the driest July on record, and water levels on the Rhine River, a vital artery for the transport of commodities and industrial goods, are so low that trade is at risk of coming to a halt. The UK, meanwhile, planning for several days over the winter when cold weather may combine with gas shortages, leading to organized blackouts for industry and even households. And Britain's booking a break in some of Europe's most popular holiday destinations this summer are seeing airfares climb by almost a third amid a booming demand, high oil prices, and curbs on airline capacity. Fares in the first week of August, the peak month for UK travel, up 30% on average for the top 36 routes compared with pre-pandemic levels. This according to numbers compiled by the online travel agency Kayak. And that is the latest from the news desk. Guy Johnson, back to you now in London.
Charlie Pellett, thank you very much indeed. US politics rocked earlier on today by news that the FBI has searched former President Donald Trump's home in Florida, in Mar-a-Lago. They were apparently looking for classified documents that were taken from the White House when he left office. This obviously part and parcel of a bigger story that is developing as we all wonder whether or not Donald Trump will run for office again. Let's try and figure out exactly what is happening here. Josh Wingrove joining us on the line from DC. Josh, what do we know about this raid?
Well, we at first didn't know which investigation that it was related to, and that just sort of gives you a sense of the multiple fronts on which law enforcement are engaging with Trump and his inner circle, including on January 6th. But this is related to the preservation of documents. The U.S. laws have strict rules about what you can take with you in a box when you leave the White House. That looks like what this is related to. And so they went there. Donald Trump was not there. He spent summertime in and around New York near his golf club there. So he wasn't on site, but we don't know yet what they took. The legal analysts are saying that they would have had need to have pretty strong evidence to get a warrant for this, to get an order to prove that they sort of had either evidence or clear indication of some sort of ongoing crime. Trump is looking to capitalize politically on this. Many Republicans are outraged. They're casting him as a victim. So there's a lot of moving parts on this one right now. But Donald Trump, of course, continues to mull whether to run in 2024. You have a hard time finding people who cover him, follow him, advise him, who think that he's not leaning towards doing just that.
Josh, does this not make it almost certain, because it's given him a huge peg of which to sort of, you know, justify a variety of different actions? And can't he just turn around and say that when he was president, which I believe was in his rights, that he's declassified any documents, he said? So this, it does make it look like it, this was a lot of pressure on the Attorney General to do something. And maybe this is the net reaction, which may not actually result in anything coming against Trump as far as that potential, you know, clear legal action.
Yeah, well, to your first point, yeah, a lot of people around him do believe that this will increase the chance that he will run or increase the timeline on his announcement. A lot of Republicans, of course, would prefer that he makes his announcement after the midterm elections. Trump, of course, pretty polarizing guy. Republicans are on an inside track right now to regain at least the House, maybe the Senate. They don't want to upend the apple cart. So, yeah, on the timing piece, that's it. As for the declassification piece, that's a power that goes away when you're no longer president. So the question hanging over this, and we simply don't know the answer, is did he take documents that he had already declassified, or did he take stuff that he hadn't, and now his sort of magic declassification wand doesn't work anymore? So that's the sort of second question on it. And so we'll see where it goes from that. I should note that some people are kind of coming out alongside him that have been critics of him lately. This includes Vice President Mike Pence, who, of course, the Trump mob on January 6th was aiming to disrupt in his counting of the votes, and former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, both sort of expressing misgivings with this raid. I think a lot of people are just sort of holding their breath to see if the FBI has the goods. If they don't have the goods, this is clearly motivating the Trump base. And, you know, who knows where that could lead. A lot of reporters who've been covering sort of the far right kind of movement have been noting pretty troubling language around this. And so there are questions about whether this could escalate again into sort of a January 6th type of realm by sort of lone actors trying to, you know, avenge what they think is a politicized FBI and DOJ.
In terms of what it would take to prevent Donald Trump from running again, where are we on that? What would need to happen for him to not be able to run in 2024?
Major health incident?
From a legal point of view. There are multiple legal challenges that he's facing at the moment. Are any of them potentially at this point capable of stopping him running?
I think it's unclear. I mean, there's a lot of Republicans who would love to sort of take the mantle a little bit. They include, yep, of course, Tim Scott of South Carolina, who's distanced himself a bit in the last 48 hours from Trump, which makes him unique in that field. But we just simply don't know. Trump loves the attention of being the kingmaker in the Republican Party. He loved the attention of being the figurehead of the Republican Party, both as president and since. That's why you do, like I said, have a hard time finding people around him, people who cover him, who think that 2024 isn't on his radar in a very serious way.
So, Josh, just How quickly do the FBI have to do something here? Because this is unprecedented, and normally you would expect that, you know, a proper search warrant or some form of subpoena is done in a manner which is not, you know, an outright raid on a former president. So does this not put the pressure on the FBI and the Attorney General in the sense to come up with something big soon?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, their standard MO here is not to comment, but there are calls from a lot of corners pointing to the sort of extreme unique situation of this, saying that they have to say something, they have to put something in the public realm. I should note that the National Archives did get some documents in January from Trump, about 15 boxes of documents at that time. So, you know, a year after he left office, and now what, some 7 months ago or so. And this raid suggests that they didn't get everything, that Trump maybe tried to withhold certain documents. But again, that's just a suggestion. We don't know.
Josh, thanks for the update. We will watch with a great deal of interest. Joining us from DC, Bloomberg's Josh Wingrove. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
So a couple of big hotel groups out with numbers a little bit earlier on today. Intercontinental Hotels out of London, and then you got Hyatt Group out of the United States. Intercontinental Hotels dropping a little bit today. The stock down by around 1%. Reporting a revenue miss, starting to flag a little bit of weakness. Certainly the analysts are concerned about that. Over in the States, Hyatt out with some strong numbers, beating estimates, and talking about a really quite strong picture, particularly in the leisure side. Doesn't see any weakness coming through there at this point, despite others in the industry beginning to grow concerned that maybe this incredibly strong period is basically getting to the point where, well, it's as good as it gets. I caught up with the Hyatt CEO a little bit earlier on. Let's hear what he had to say on this matter.
My short answer to your question is no. For several reasons. The first is the real driver of recovery to date has been leisure travel, and that continues to be exceedingly strong. And we're seeing that persistence of demand heading in through July and even the first week of August. The pace of leisure travel continues to be very strong. And bookings out into the fourth quarter of this year and into the first quarter of next year for leisure travel are also very strong. Group travel, that is companies and associations that come together for convenings, in July, for the first time in our system, recovered to 2019 levels. So we're just back to 2019 levels, even as leisure has been tracking almost 20% above 2019. So the segments of group travel and business transient travel, individual business travelers, has yet to really fully recover. And we have a long way to go there. So I think we're going to see continued demand growth over the coming quarters.
So, Mark, leisure, clearly a bright spot. But are you at all worried that this is pent-up demand? And obviously the word of the month, the word of this year has been recession. And I'm curious what past experiences with recessions tells us about what that does to leisure travel.
So we serve the high-end traveler, and we our representation is in higher rated segments in the industry. So we believe that for our customer base, there will be a higher level of resiliency and persistence of demand through any economic uncertainty that we see. And that is consistent with what we saw in prior downturns. That is, our customer base was first to return to travel, and leisure led the way. So we are positioned now as a company, after our acquisition of the Apple Leisure Group last year, to have more than 50% of our revenues coming from leisure. And the guest base that we are serving is in a category of income levels that allows them to actually plan ahead and then complete their trips. So we are not terribly concerned about the economic uncertainty that might exist.
You referenced business travel just a moment ago, so let's just spend a moment talking about that if we can, Mark.
Sure.
Office occupancy levels are very low and seem to be remaining very, very low. How much of a lead indicator is that into what happens with business travel and the numbers you see?
We see an increase in return to office across our key customers. there was a dynamic in which small and medium-sized enterprises actually started to grow as a proportion of our total revenue base, even as large accounts came down. That's starting to actually turn around. Our large accounts are showing significant recovery.
That was the CEO of Hyatt speaking to Katie Greifeld and myself a little bit earlier on. Marcus, it's interesting. You talk to the travel guys. They're all incredibly optimistic. They see this demand holding up. I find that really hard to believe.
Well, recession, what recession? If you look at a whole bunch of things, from employment onwards, wage rises, and certainly job vacancies, and you know this sort of revenge holiday or tourism isn't going away. There's maybe it's just two different, it's a K-shaped recovery. There's two different ways, different worlds, really.
But isn't most of this discretionary spending? That's kind of what it feels like.
A lot of savings spent up from the pandemic. So yeah, I think there's a lot of momentum behind it.
Energy bills rising rapidly. It's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. Some of them are beginning to talk about early indications the demand is beginning to slow. It's going to be interesting to see how that feeds out. Inflation is going to be the big subject of tomorrow. US CPI. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening, welcome back. You're listening to The Cable, 5:48 in the City of London. Tomorrow will be dominated by one number or one set of numbers. US inflation data will be hitting the Bloomberg terminal at 1:30 London time. The expectation is that the headline number will slow to 8.7% from 9.1, but core will pick up from 5.9% to 6.1. Clearly, this is important. It's probably been made more important by the very strong data we saw last Friday on the payroll front. The labour market is very strong, but is there any evidence that inflation is softening? Let's talk about this some more. It's going to be a big deal tomorrow. Bloomberg US senior US economist Yelena Shuletieva joining us now on the line. Yelena, is the risk to that headline number to the upside or the downside?
The headline number is not a concern. So for the next couple of months, we'll get benign readings. So as you mentioned, you know, the headline number will be actually consistent with the Fed's 2% target for July, if you just take it at the face value. But of course, what's really important, what happens next, going into the next year, and more importantly, what happens to core inflation to prices excluding food and energy. And we think that it will continue to, be really, really high. So when forecasters broadly agree that inflation will slow in July, there is a lot of discrepancy about what happens to inflation going into the next year. CPI forecasts for the second quarter of next year span a wide range of from around 2% to almost 8% for CPI. So we're at a higher point. We think that inflation will remain sticky because wages continue to rise. And today's data on productivity and unit labor costs just confirms that.
Yelena, is the other thing owner's equivalent rental shelter, as in housing costs? Is that the sort of the sticky thing, which is when that starts to rise, it carries on rising for quite a long while? It's one of these things that you don't want to see building. Is that the main problem?
That is one of the key issues as well. So so-called owner's equivalent rent, how much you think you can rent out your property for, and just directly rents of property, those things are rising at an increasing pace. And that is a result of early increases in outright rent prices. So what happens when government tallies those costs, they come into the calculation with a lag. And that's why those costs are so sticky. So now what we see now is a result of previous increases, and unfortunately those are just, continue to accelerate and will probably not, reverse anytime soon. So at least this year we will continue to see those prices rising.
Yelena, if the consumer thinks that inflation is now, the peak in inflation is now behind us, and inflation expectations start to come down for the consumer, as evidenced by the New York Fed survey, and maybe we'll see it in the Michigan data this Friday. Will the Fed be more relaxed about its approach to tackling inflation?
I think Fed is now looking at the data on wages, on unit labor costs, on pay per hour, those the data that we received today, and you know the evidence is not very comforting at all. So I think you know what happens to inflation expectations really depends on oil prices, gasoline prices, and you know you have to be a really smart forecaster to predict those things. You know, a geopolitical situation really you know makes a lot of influence on that, but wages are rising, and they're rising at an increased pace. So that is a real concern for the Fed, and that's what will keep them hiking rates very aggressively. We expect another 75 basis point hike at the next meeting.
In September. What do you expect, Yelena, from Jackson Hole? I mean, do you think they're going to alter? I hold out hope that one of these days, one central bank's going to alter its inflation mandate to be a bit more flexible. Are we going to get anything substantive on, you know, changes to how the Fed might go about looking things in the future from that, Jackson Hole?
Potentially. I think it would be a really great opportunity for Chair Powell to really make it clear that you know, the Fed needs to fight inflation at any cost and to avoid the situation of the early 70s and 80s. And really, like, now is not the time to stop. I think that could be a revelation for the markets, which expect some cuts very soon down the road, that, you know, the Fed will back off. I think, you know, it's a really good chance. It's like it would be a Bernanke moment for Chair Powell to really say something strong to the markets and just, you know, persuade them that the Fed is really serious about tackling inflation.
There's been some chat about an interim meeting hike. And I was talking to Mike McKee about this earlier on. Would the Fed really have to bother with an interim meeting hike? All the Fed presumably would have to do is exactly what you're saying, i.e. say we're going to be tougher on inflation, say we're going to do more, and the market would price it instantly.
I think, you know, the timing is actually very, works very well for the Fed at this point. So Jackson Hole is just a couple of weeks away, and at that time, Chair Powell can set up expectations. Yep. Just, you know, similarly to what Bernanke did a few years ago, setting up expectations for QE3, and then at the September meeting, deliver another aggressive hike. So, and provide some guidance. You know, they don't want to provide very clear forward guidance, but provide some guidance on being aggressive going forward.
Yelena, great stuff. Thank you very much indeed. Yelena Shilatyeva joining us ahead of the CPI print tomorrow. As I say, the headline number expected to drop from 9.1 to 8.7, but the core number to pick up to 6.1 from 5.9. That wraps things up. We'll have great coverage of that number tomorrow right here on Bloomberg. From Marcus and from me, this was The Cable. This is Bloomberg.